I know that alternatives are possible, and that you constantly see how hard the establishment has to work to maintain order. Look at all these institutions, the banks of the Thames, lined with institutions to hold ordinary people down. Constantly through the media, they try to prevent different arguments emerging. That is because they know change is inevitable. Change is just a different story. We, people in the media, have an obligation to reframe this argument, to tell people that they can change the world, that we are connected to one another, we have more in common with each other, we have more in common with the people we're bombing than the people we're bombing them for. People that say the system works, work for the system. We can change the world. The revolution can begin as soon as you decide it does. In yourself, Amy.
So there you have it. Russell Brand, his new book is called Revolution.
And Noam Chomsky is a cannibal.
That does it for our show. And I want to thank all the folks who've made this broadcast possible. Special thanks to Mike Burke and Renee Feltz and Nermeen Sheikh and Aaron Maté and Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Dennis Moyne.
No, he was
terrible. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Dennis was
useless. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for
joining
us.
Dennis, you should be ashamed.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBOO Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Dime Roberts. In 1989, I took a trip to Taiwan with my mother and produced a radio documentary about our relationship. It's called Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song.
Well, I know our Buddha take me to heaven. I didn't want to come by, she told me. It's not my time yet. If my time come, that's my home.
Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song won the Peabody and was played all over the world. For the 25th anniversary, I've turned this personal radio production into a film. Join me November 21st at 8 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for the first ever screening of Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the KBOO homepage under Community Events.
The time is now 5:02. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... The U.S. House of Representatives approves the Keystone Pipeline.
Walmart workers in California protest working conditions.
And Portlanders protest the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 14th, 2014. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. President Obama is in Asia this week to try to jumpstart the stalled Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. But local environmental groups held a protest today demanding that the president stop his push for a Trans-Pacific so-called free trade agreement. The protesters gathered outside Senator Ron Wyden's and Congressman Earl Blumenauer's offices to urge them to oppose fast-track authority for the pact. KBOO reporters Jamie Partridge and Joanna Peterson were at the rally in Portland today. They bring us the sounds of the street.
Fast-track contract! Fast-track contract!
I'm Ted Gleichman. I am chair of the Sierra Club's Beyond LNG team.
What's going on out here this afternoon?
Today we came out to protest to key members of Congress about the plans for the secret corporate trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the effort to ram this through Congress on what's called a fast-track program, where Congress gets no chance to do anything other than vote it up or down. And because this has been secret through years of negotiations, except for leaks and very selective releases of limited information, the general public has no access to knowing exactly what's going on with the largest corporate trade deal in global history.
And can you tell me a little bit more about what the Trans-Pacific Partnership would do?
So this is not your grandparents' trade deal. This is not two countries deciding that one has a particular raw material and the other has a particular manufacturing capability and that they ought to get together and make a deal that is in everybody's best interest. Now, a lot of the time, even that kind of model didn't work very well. A lot of we know well how countries in the global south were exploited and manipulated in those kinds of deals. But this is much, much worse. This is NAFTA and the World Trade Organization on steroids. It's 27 chapters covering everything from pharmaceuticals and intellectual property to exporting natural gas and the ability for corporations, not just governments, but corporations to sue governments for potential lost profits for environmental or labor regulations that those corporations believe would be bad for their business. It's a global takeover of sovereignty, of trade in a new definition. This is corporate trade in the same sense that politics now is corporate money.
President Obama was just in China announcing a U.S.-China joint agreement to reduce carbon emissions. How does this play into that?
So that is not directly related because China is not part of the negotiating efforts for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But China and the U.S. are the two largest economies, the two largest emitters of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and the two biggest users of fossil fuels, which are the cause of the changes that we're all living with in terms of our climate being disrupted. So it is very important that this small step forward took place. But we have to be very clear that in terms of what really needs to happen to preserve a livable climate for the rest of this century and beyond, it is a small step. This is not the end of the story. It's a step forward, but much, much more needs to be done, and that needs to happen on the local level, on the state level, and whenever we can push for it on the federal and international level.
That was Ted Gleichman with the Sierra Club, and I'm Joanna Peterson with KBOO News. We're at a rally where local environmental groups are urging Senator Wyden and Representative Blumenauer to oppose a fast track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Here's KBOO's Jamie Partridge.
I'm out here with Elizabeth Swagert, who is the director of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. I noticed that the one of the signs here says protect workers and the environment. What is protect workers? What's that about?
Well, you know, a lot of the jobs that that the Obama administration has been working on has been green jobs. Again, that's an area that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be allowed to attack because it allows corporations, foreign corporations, to sue a local government if they believe that a policy competes with their ability to make future profits. So really, you know, it's more than just an environmental issue. It's a jobs issue. And it goes beyond that. You know, it affects almost every aspect of our lives, from the food we eat, labeling. It affects, of course, jobs. It affects the access that we have to affordable medication. Almost every spectrum will be touched by the TPP.
So what can our listeners do to impact this process, this fast track, the legislation in Congress?
Well, the best thing that people can do right now is pick up your phone and call your representative and let them know that we need to stop fast track for the TPP.
All right, Elizabeth Swagert, Director of Oregon Fair Trade.
The Republican-led House of Representatives approved construction of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline this morning, taking that decision away from the Obama administration. The Keystone debate has become a central focus in the Louisiana Senate runoff election, which is set for December 6th. Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu is pushing for a vote on the pipeline before her runoff election. Her opponent, Republican Representative Bill Cassidy, sponsored the House bill and is favored to win Landrieu's seat in the Senate in the December 6th election. Landrieu is hoping to win support from Republican voters in her state by pushing forward the Senate version of the bill, which she co-sponsors. There is no candidate in Louisiana runoff election that opposes the Keystone XL pipeline, and both candidates are currently trying to compete on who is a bigger supporter of the pipeline. The Senate is set to vote Tuesday on the bill, which will move to President Obama for signature if it achieves 60 votes. Environmental groups are pressuring the president to veto the pipeline's construction if the Senate passes the bill.
This week, previously undisclosed records showed that Governor John Kitzhaber used his re-election campaign advisors to covertly direct his administration's response to the failure of Cover Oregon, the state's health insurance exchange. Emails show that Patricia McCaig, a top campaign advisor to Governor Kitzhaber, coordinated with Cover Oregon interim director Clyde Hemstreet and chief of staff Mike Bonetto. The coordination included Governor Kitzhaber's explanation to Congress as to why Cover Oregon failed. Another example was that campaign staff directed state communications on the dispute with Oracle Corporation, the private corporation that helped construct the site. While it's often privately acknowledged at Salem, the blending of electoral politics and public policy is not supposed to happen.
The rideshare company Uber was announced on Wednesday to have launched service in Beaverton, Gresham, Hillsboro, and Tigard. Uber exists in over 200 cities but has not found much success in Portland. Reports say that the mayors of cities in which Uber has been launched approached the company about bringing the rideshare services due to a lack of services provided by taxis in other localities. Owner and general manager of Union Cab, Kadir, says that local cab services are concerned about the effects of Uber in the surrounding cities around Portland. Kebu Sequoia Wright has more.
I just want to get your opinion in terms of how you feel as the owner of Union Cab, and then also are some thoughts of your drivers about Uber.
I've been opposing this on the city meeting, and when the Uber came to the city of Portland and announced the request to launch in Portland. And object one is Uber doesn't hurt only the cab driver's business, it hurt also the public. And those drivers who work for Uber, they are not licensed by auto commercial insurance. And they can get their own personal insurance and run the business just as far as they get out to any vehicles. Two, those public doesn't have a credit card are discriminated. They don't serve those people, only people with special interest, commercial business people or rich people only. And those old ladies are not going to be served still like we cab drivers do. People with wheelchair, accessible people with disability are discriminated by them because they don't serve them. Cab drivers cover all this and work with the public. And we are there for the community, for elderly people, for people with disability. That is why cab drivers are on the street.
Are there laws regulating how Uber will operate?
Yeah, first of all, the cab industry is regulated by the city, and so we go under the regulation of cities, and we generate the revenue to the city too. And Uber doesn't generate any revenue to the city. All they want to take is online credit card, and then that's it. You know, they don't open any office, they don't hire any employee in the city town. Nothing benefit to the community, and that also to the city too.
There's a possibility that Portland might concede and let Uber do work here. How will this affect the livelihood of drivers?
It's gonna hurt the livelihood of cab drivers. It doesn't matter if the cab drivers who owned the company or cab drivers list for the other cab companies. Still, what we're going to do is we are hoping that the city of Portland doesn't allow them to operate in Portland. If they operate in Portland, it's going to be get a mess. We're organizing the cab drivers from all cab companies. We're going to shut down the city, not to serve the public for that day, and also to the airport. That's what we want to do. But we are still working with the city, the city councils are still with us. We are hoping that they still will keep it that way.
All right. I've been speaking with Kadir, owner of Union Cab. Well, thank you very much, Kadir, for taking some time.
Thank you.
And for KBOO Evening News, this is Sequoyna Wright.
A dozen Walmart workers were arrested in Los Angeles last night for blocking a street to protest their working conditions. The street blockade followed another action earlier yesterday in which workers staged the first ever sit-down strike at a Walmart store. Over the last year, Walmart workers have pressured Walmart to change its pregnancy policy, provide access to more hours, and to raise the wages for minimum wage workers. Walmart has retaliated against workers demanding better wages and working conditions. More information on upcoming actions can be found at BlackFridayProtests.com or on Twitter at #ChangeWalmart.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a high of 41, but down into the 20s at night. Sunday will see sunnier skies with a high of 43. Today in history, in 1889, feminist journalist Nellie Bly started her endeavor to travel the world in 80 days. She completed her journey 72 days later. On November 14, 1921, the Communist Party of Spain was founded. And just 2 years ago on this date, Israel launched Operation Pillar of Defense by killing Hamas military chief Ahmad Jabari. The operation lasted 1 week, killed over 167 Palestinians, and wounded another 1,000. Of those killed, almost half were civilians. The quote of the day comes from Nellie Bly, who urged us to, quote, accept praise for its worth, politeness, be brutally frank with yourself, it's safer, end quote.
It's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a random thought that might not have occurred to you. It's not easy being rich. Well, yes, there are all those things that money can buy to alleviate the burden of fabulous wealth. Things like servants, summers in Provence, private jets, and such. But as an article in the Wealth section of the New York Times reminds us, money buys things, not happiness. And the article reports that America's poor upper one percenters are not happy. The chief source of super-rich sadness? Overwork. It seems that our vaunted CEOs and Wall Street titans feel as though they're always on the clock, expected to be in charge of every little facet of their business. But before you fall into uncontrollable weeping over their suffering, let me give you the good news that whole flocks of psychologists, neuroscientists, and other healers are rushing to conquer this tragic malaise of the rich. They've even coined a term for the trauma, stress of high status. The main symptom of SHS syndrome, we're told, is the feeling of always being rushed for time. Excuse me, but if all these soothers of the elite think high status is stressful, they might examine the lives of those with low status. Try being a single mom with a couple of kids who's juggling two part-time fast food jobs and her kids' schedules while worrying about making the rent this month and then having her car break down. Yet the Times devotes a full page to the pseudo-misery of these pampered ones, even citing a prominent psychologist who laments that, quote, wealthy people spend less time doing pleasurable things and more time doing compulsory things and feeling stressed. This is Jim Hightower saying, what? Less time on pleasurable things and more time doing, quote, compulsory things than that single mom? Get a grip. The sickness that has infected the wealthy class is not stress, but a plague of narcissism. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
On Monday, President Obama outlined his suggestions to the Federal Communications Commission on preserving net neutrality. The FCC is currently trying to decide how much to regulate broadband and internet service providers. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler remains a central figure in this debate, and on the same day as President Obama's announcement, activists blockaded Wheeler's home. KABU reporter Ryan Katz spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press, about President Obama's plan and a potential response from the FCC.
Net neutrality is a fundamental principle that's been part of the internet since its inception, and it just means that when you go online, you should be able to go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want, and it's not up to your internet service provider to dictate which services work and which don't. In other words, net neutrality really just means no discrimination by your internet service provider, your phone, or your cable company. The reason we're still debating net neutrality, which seems kind of like an obvious thing we should always have, is that for a number of years, the Federal Communications Commission has been trying to make rules to protect net neutrality. And the last two times they've tried to do so, those rules have been thrown out in the federal courts because of the way the FCC tried to apply its authority. And there's been a heated debate happening in Washington and increasingly all over the country throughout this entire year about what the FCC's next set of rules should look like and the steps they should take to actually restore their authority so they can protect internet users. And just this week, President Obama came out with a very strong statement and a very detailed plan about what those rules should look like. His approach really matches what a lot of us in the public interest community have been advocating for a long time. And now we need to see if the Federal Communications Commission, who's in charge of making these rules, is actually going to follow through and do it.
The FCC is an independent agency, correct?
That's right. The FCC is independent, which means the president can't just tell them what to do. He can't just say, do exactly this and boss them around. But it is still a political agency. In other words, all five commissioners were appointed by the president. And depending on who's in the White House, they get a majority at the FCC. So there are currently three Democratic commissioners, two Republican commissioners. So while they are independent, the president's views are certainly very influential.
What were some of the components of President Obama's plan that he came out with this week?
So the really important thing is that the president said magic words that mean a lot at the FCC called Title II. And Title II is the portion of the Communications Act that governs two-way communications or telecommunications. And he was very clear that the FCC needs to have authority under Title II to regulate broadband access. That's what's been missing. Because they've lacked that authority, they haven't been able to make rules that would stop things like website blocking and unreasonable discrimination and fast lanes that are provided for just a few companies while the rest of us are stuck in the slow road. Title II is what also ensures that consumers, competitors, and others can actually file complaints with the FCC if they feel like a phone or cable company is violating their rights. And that's basically what the president's plan outlined, is making sure that we have rules to do all those things and clarifying that really the only way to do that is with this so-called Title II authority.
Also this week, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler has been coming under particular scrutiny. What is his role in this process?
Well, you know, he is really the main driver of this process. The FCC is an independent agency, and the chairman of the FCC is the one who gets to set the agenda, and it's his staff that really would write any new rules like this, you know, with the help of the various bureaus at the agency. Now, anything the chairman of the FCC does, he's got to get a majority of votes, and the two Republicans on the commission have been very clear that they're not voting for any kind of net neutrality rules. So they've essentially already taken themselves out of the conversation. They're going to oppose whatever the chairman does. So he needs the votes of his other two Democratic colleagues. But there's a lot of power in his role because he sets the calendar, he sets the agenda, he decides when these rules will move forward. And there are conflicting reports out of the FCC about how open he is to the president's proposal. That said, he was appointed by the president. He was a big booster of the president before he got this job. There are reasons to think that the president is going to have a lot of sway. At the same time, the chairman of the FCC himself is a former cable and wireless industry lobbyist. So a lot of people are asking questions about that, maybe questions that should have been asked a long time ago, but that are coming up now as he is the one making these rules. But ultimately, it is Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC, who will be the one deciding whether we get real net neutrality or not.
Is there anything that you want to add that you think our listeners should know?
Yeah, I'll just add one thing, and that's just to note that a lot of people are asking, why did the president make this move now? And I think the only answer that makes sense is that he recognized how much public pressure there was and how popular these kind of net neutrality policies were with the public. 4 million people have filed comments with the FCC opposing their old plan. That's 4 times as many people who have commented on anything in the history of the FCC.
I have been speaking with Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
Today, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders called on the Postal Service to stop service cuts and job losses. He pointed to a new report that revenue for the mail delivery service rose by $569 million during the fiscal year that just ended. This was the second year in a row that profits rose, mainly because of increases in package deliveries to online shoppers. Despite $1 billion in revenue growth over the past 2 years, the Postal Service is forging ahead with plans to shut down as many as 82 mail processing plants beginning in January. The closings would put 15,000 jobs in jeopardy. Today, the Board of Governors appointed Megan J. Brennan to be the new Postmaster General. A top aide to outgoing Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe, Brennan has pursued some of the same damaging proposals to cut services and eliminate jobs. Revenue for mail delivery is rising, but USPS bookkeepers showed a deficit for the past year. That's because of an onerous and unprecedented Bush-era law that requires it to pre-fund 75 years of future retiree health benefits for a program that already has more than enough reserves set aside. Without the mandate, the Postal Service would have made an operating profit of $823 million over the past 2 years. The unnecessary financial burden on the Postal Service would be relieved under legislation Sanders introduced in 2013. It now has 28 co-sponsors. The Sanders bill would also modernize the Postal Service and let it expand its business operations without the need to cut services or eliminate Saturday mail.
Women's reproductive rights are under attack across the country, and these attacks include direct assaults on pregnant women. This is according to a new report by the National Advocates for Pregnant Women. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with the group's executive director, Lynn Paltrow, today about the new report and her op-ed in the New York Times this week.
I wonder if you could talk about some of the instances that you mentioned in your article. It seems that in some states, women can be imprisoned for having a miscarriage.
Yes. The point of our commentary is to help people recognize that anti-abortion measures are used to hurt all pregnant women. And whether the state actually authorizes it or not, because many of the cases we found were not specifically authorized by any law, women have been forced to have cesarean surgery over their objections and despite the fact they didn't need them. In one case, a woman was picked up by a sheriff, taken to the hospital in active labor with her legs strapped together, allowed to quote-unquote represent herself before she was subjected to major surgery to which she did not consent, and later births proved were unnecessary. cases in which women have gone to the hospital and somebody said, look, you're miscarrying, you should stay here, and saying, look, I'm going to let God do whatever God wants. I have two little kids at home, and finding herself taken prisoner at the hospital, forced to undergo surgery, and still experiencing the miscarriage and stillbirth. All of these kinds of cases are justified on the same arguments being used to try to end legal abortion in the United States.
Now, these state statutes that are working to undermine Roe v. Wade, are they being challenged legally? Does it appear that there will be a legal challenge that eventually gets brought to the Supreme Court to challenge Roe v. Wade itself?
That's the plan. That's been the long-term strategy by those who'd like to see Roe overturned. And the issue really is, and I do want to make clear that a lot of this is happening, it's across all party lines, that some of these laws have been passed with the approval and support of Democrats as well as Republicans, although there's no question that the Republican National Committee's specifically on their agenda is ending legal abortion, which will mean arrests of pregnant women, by the way. But the question, one of these cases will eventually get to the Supreme Court, probably sooner than later, and the question will be, will the Supreme Court justices understand that whatever case comes to them, even if it appears narrowly to be about abortion, will set precedent that will affect the lives and health and personhood of all pregnant women?
Wow. And these cases that you mention in the article, they seem really extreme, where a woman is arrested on charges of fetal homicide for delaying a cesarean, another woman dying in a forced cesarean, and she and her child died in that. Are these isolated incidents? Are these kind of the most extreme that are really uncommon in this country?
Well, it's both, on the one hand, one could think of it that way, but they're all too common. We've been looking at cases from 1973 until today. We have documented over 700 of these cases. And considering that there should be no law that can constitutionally allow any of these things, they are far too common. I'll tell you about two recent cases. In Florida, a woman came in for